Welcome to The Ralph Report with Ralph Garman.
Hey there, boys and girls. Welcome to The Ralph Report for a Friday. We made it to the end of the week, and of course it is Star Wars Day as well. So I just want to wish all of you a happy Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you on this May 4th Friday. It is a pleasure to spend some time with you, of course, as we wrap up the week. Got a good show today. We have, of course, the movie beat, because all the new movies are in the theaters this weekend, so we'll take a look at what's new in theaters. Steve Ashton will stop by to kick off our weekend with a little news from the UK. We have the rest of my interview with Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, the geniuses behind the Joe Schmo Show, seasons 1 and 2, and 3, too. They weren't on hand exactly when we were producing it, but it was their baby, so they were there in spirit. And I hope we can kick off your weekend in high style, get you ready for some fun. I'm going to go off this weekend and shoot a little role in this independent thriller that I got cast in, which is always fun when I get to be on a set and play in a sandbox with some other actors and directors and folks like that who do it for real. I just dabble, but these folks are the real deal. So that's going to be fun. I'll tell you all about that next week. Speaking of next week, also, I will be on the road with Mr. Kevin Smith. We are going to Canada next week. We're going to be touring with Hollywood Babylon, going to 3 stops in 4 days. We're going to be doing Calgary, then Edmonton, and then Vancouver later on next week. So I will be doing the Ralph Report, but I will be doing it from various hotel rooms around the Great White North. So I don't even know if it's white anymore, right? It's springtime. It's probably not white anymore, but Canada. That's where I'll be. If you're in any of those cities, by the way, I think there's still tickets left for all those shows. If you want to come out and see us, we'd love to have you there. You can go to csmod.com to get tickets for those 3 shows and all of the Smodcast shows that Kevin Smith does with myself and other folks. So come on out and join us. Regarding the Ralph Report and our 5-star generals in the Garmy, I want to give a shout out to those guys because we have chosen the next 5 4-star generals who will be getting a phone call from me as a thank you for their support. We do this every month. We go into the ranks of the 4-star generals and we pull out 5 names at random. And then I set up phone calls, you know, we prearrange it and then we get a chance to chat and hang out. And it has been, I got to tell you, my favorite part of this whole process so far is how cool you guys are and the fun conversations that we have. So we have picked our names for May, and I did want to give a shout-out to these guys. Chris Butler. Chris, you and I will be talking sometime this month. We're going to arrange that. James Schick is also one of the 5 4-star generals that we'll be speaking with this month. Satchmo, a.k.a. Susie King. Or is it Susie King, a.k.a. Satchmo? We're going to be talking Mike Ferrell. And Jesse Schaefer are the 5 4-star generals that I'll be chatting with this month. So expect a contact email from my lovely wife, Carrie. She's the one who does all the hard work of setting all this stuff up. She's going to reach out and contact you, and then we'll find a good time for you, and I'll give you a call, and we'll chat. And it's no holds barred, so anything goes. You can ask me about anything, and always enjoy the conversations. So that's good stuff. Meanwhile, let's get this party started, shall we, by taking a look at all the show business news. Boy, Ryan Reynolds seems like a good guy, doesn't he? Of course, Deadpool 2 is coming up soon. Once again, it's all connected, written by Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, the guys who created the Joe Schmo Show. So he's doing a lot of press, and he did an interview with the New York Times, and I thought it was terrific, because on this show alone, in the past couple of months, we've talked a bunch about anxiety and depression, and my own issues with anxiety issues like claustrophobia, and we've talked to therapists about it. It's a problem for a lot of people. And you think Ryan Reynolds, good-looking guy, super talented, got the world by the ass. He wouldn't have a care in the world, but he has suffered from anxiety his whole life. And he does an interview with the New York Times where he talks about how debilitating it can get for him. He admits that he gets nauseous, physically ill, before every talk show appearance that he does. That's how anxious he gets about it. It all stems from his childhood, where he had a difficult time growing up, making peace between his dad and his 3 older brothers growing up there in Canada. And It has affected him his whole life. Interestingly enough, and he says this, and I think a lot of performers feel this way, he gets incredibly anxious just in general in life, and then just before he performs, and then when he hits a stage or a set, he has a different aspect of his personality that takes over and kind of gets him through. So, I think it's that way with a lot of performers. So if you can, get a chance to read the article. It's fascinating, especially if you suffer from anxiety. You can relate to what he's talking about. But yeah, a lifelong struggle for Ryan Reynolds. Speaking of Ryan Reynolds and Deadpool 2, you have to seek out the new video for the song featured on the soundtrack of Deadpool 2 by Celine Dion. It's called Ashes. You got to find the video. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but it features Celine Dion performing very dramatically in an empty theater, and Ryan Reynolds also participates in the video. Again, I don't want to spoil it for you. You should find it on your own and experience it firsthand like I did. But I will tell you at the end, I will spoil a little thing at the end. There's an interaction between Celine Dion and Deadpool, which is very, very funny. So I wanted to play it for you here. Just a little teaser for the new video that's out now.
Celine! That was amazing! That was the most beautiful performance I've ever seen in my life.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
No, thank you. We need to do it again.
Okay. Why?
Well, it's too good. Yeah, this is Deadpool 2, not Titanic. All right, you're at like an 11. We need to get you down to a 5, 5.5 tops. Just phone it in.
Listen, this thing only goes to 11. So beat it, Spider-Man.
God, I should have asked NSYNC.
And by the way, I don't know how many filters are on the camera that is shooting Celine Dion in this video, but she's almost unrecognizable because you can't really see her through the gauze and haze that they've created in this video. I'm not sure what's happening there. I'm sure she thinks it makes her look younger or better, but it looks like someone just smeared yogurt on the lens. So maybe that's the look they were going for. Many years ago, Rick Ocasek, the frontman for the band The Cars, popular 70s and 80s band, married the spectacularly hot model and actress Paulina Poroskova. And at the time, many of us, out of jealousy, said, ha, it'll never last, because Rick Ocasek has an Adam's apple bigger than the rest of his head, and he looks like an alien, and she is spectacular and deserves better than him. He's a weaselly weirdo. And we were all very jealous, and we said, this relationship will never last. Ha ha! We're right! We were proved right! After 28 years of marriage, the two have split up. Apparently, they've been apart for some time now. Paulina Poroskova said, our family's always been and still is a well-built car. And when the four of us together, we can go wherever the road takes us. But as a bicycle, my husband and I no longer pedal in unison, so we're ditching the bicycle. They've been split up for the past year. Apparently, they're still very friendly, though. Family gets together. Everybody's very happy because, of course, you know, they're celebrities. And they're more in love now, separate than they ever were when they were together. So, congratulations. They still make their family work. But we were right all those years ago, saying it would never last. We just had to wait 28 years to be right. It was very touching this week to see Mike Myers on the Jimmy Kimmel Live show, talking about his old co-star, Vern Troyer, who passed away recently. It looked like the two were really close. He got choked up while he was talking about him, but I thought it was very sweet. He gave him a very nice send-off. And although he did die young at 48, Myers referred to the fact that because of his particular kind of dwarfism, he wasn't even supposed to last beyond his teens. So guy packed a lot of life into his life, and Myers talked about going to this memorial service that they had for him and how moved everybody was.
Vern was a fantastic human being, and, yeah.
Oh, good. You worked with him for a long time.
I worked with him for a long time.
Yeah.
And a great comedian. I always just want to make that point that, as written, Mini-Me is, like, almost a prop. But he brought it up off the page, made it better than written, and we just ended up giving him more and more stuff to do. But a great physical comedian, a great dancer, just a fantastic guy. And at the memorial, they played... He died at 49. He wasn't supposed to live past his teens. And you saw 150 years worth of life in this photo montage. Everybody was just watching this thing.
Myers also told a story where he was at the White House with President Obama, and the first thing Obama asked him was, how's Mini-Me? So even world leaders wanted to talk about Mini-Me. You know, I love the collectibles, and there is a big auction coming up. The Profiles in History Auction House does great stuff with costumes and props and screen use stuff from movies and TV shows. They're famous for it, and they've got a big auction coming up June 5th through the 8th here in Los Angeles. They're selling some really cool stuff, including the Schwarzenegger Harley Davidson that he rode in Terminator 2 Judgment Day, the leather jacket worn by Schwarzenegger in the first Terminator film, an actual practice chariot used during the production of Ben-Hur way back in the day. But this is the gem in the collection. This is the one everyone's going to be bidding on. A lightsaber wielded by Obi-Wan Kenobi himself. Alex Guinness's screen-used lightsaber in Star Wars, headed to the auction block. Any idea what that's going to go for? It's got to be millions. But it's pretty cool. So, look, maybe it's time to break the piggy bank. See if you can get yourself a lightsaber. All right, let's take a look at the celebrity birthdays today. Born on this day, May 4th, actor Richard Jenkins. Do you see The Shape of Water? He played the neighbor in that film. How terrific is that guy? He's a great actor in everything he does. 71 years old today. Anna Gasteyer from Saturday Night Live. I did a tour of a show called The Real Live Brady Bunch around the country, where we took actual Brady Bunch episodes and performed them live on stage. It was kind of a parody of the Bradys, but we did it by playing it straight. And I played Peter Brady in the cast, and Anna Gasteyer, this is well before Saturday Night Live, she played Alice, our housekeeper, in that production. And she's a great lady and very talented. 51 years old today. Will Arnett, from Arrested Development fame, of course, but more importantly, he's Lego Batman. He is 48 years old. Mike Dirnt of Green Day is 46. Lance Bass from NSYNC, who just got their star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame the other day, 39 years old. Actress Ruth Negga from Loving and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. She is an actress who makes everyone very nervous when you have to say her name. She is 37 years old today. And legendary surf guitarist Dick Dale, one of the creators of the surf guitar sound, Dick Dale, probably best known for Miserloo, his classic hit song. If you ever saw Pulp Fiction, you know what I'm talking about. Here's a little taste. That's who was born today, May 4th. I'm Ralph Garman. I walk the showbiz beat. And while we're talking about entertainment news, I would be remiss if I didn't do one of my favorite things. Talk to our friend from the UK who's got all the show business news from across the pond, Mr. Steve Ashton. And our favorite way to wind up the week before we get into the weekend is to spend one more brief moment of joy with our friend and UK correspondent, Mr. Steve Ashton. How are you, Steve?
Oh, I'm good. Thanks, Ralph. The man who has a sign in his back cave that logs the days since his last Twitter war. How many days has it been?
I think we're up to four now.
Oh, well done. Now, the royals are in the news, of course, here, Ralph. Prince William and Kate's adorable baby, Prince Louis, has no doubt been inundated with gifts. But one present will have stood out from the rest, and it's James Corden's. Now, the TV star is believed to have sent a 23-book Beatrix Potter collection and plush toys to the prince, which will come in handy in about 18 months, I imagine, 2 years tops. What a pain in the ass present that is. Now, I know they're not struggling for room. I mean, they're not looking to build an attic for extra storage, but 23 books, well, where are they going to put them? The limited edition range is estimated to cost around £540. That's about $3,000, Ralph. Which, of course, James Corden definitely went out to buy himself. Or maybe he re-gifted a bunch of free stuff that he got for voicing the rabbit in the animated movie.
Oh, of course. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Or more likely, I mean, you will know this, Ralph, being all showbiz and that. And more likely, his publicist organized it for it to be sent via the licensees of the property and the publishers of the book, and his PA did all the fucking work. But William and Kate are believed to have adorned the nursery of Prince Louis with Peter Rabbit pieces, although given the royals' love of hunting, it's probably mixed in with elephant heads and white tigers. But do you know why the prince was called Prince Louis? It's an interesting story.
I thought that was strange. No, I don't.
No, me neither. I don't give a shit. But incidentally, do you know, I think I should do a special report on the royals and just drop some knowledge.
That would be so helpful because, you know, with all the news about the royals over here with the wedding coming up, I think many of us would love a little tutorial.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me get onto that. I'll get onto that in the next couple of weeks because the royal wedding, of course, is on the 19th. So I'll get something done in time for that. But incidentally, Prince William is on paternity leave. Paternity leave from what? Poncing off the working classes and taxpayers and proletariat by doing even less than he normally does. Maybe just ordering the army of nannies and wet nurses around, I don't know.
Maybe he's cutting back on his polo or something.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. But from the future king to a current queen, Sir Elton John has signed up to read a CBeebies bedtime story. Now, CBeebies, for everyone who doesn't know, Ralph, is a children's channel that's run by the BBC. Now, the singer, who, by the way, is 71 years old, will tell preschool viewers the story of the dog detectives lost in London. Now, he's the latest big name to sign up for that slot, which has featured, Tom Hardy, as himself, not as Bane. That would be fucking scary. Dolly Parton's done it, which presumably makes the kids just feel hungry. Damian Lewis, and guess what? Captain America himself, Chris Evans. And here's a quick clip of the Cap.
Hi, I'm Chris. You know, being a superhero can really be tough sometimes. You have good days and bad days. And that's what tonight's bedtime story is all about. It's called Even Superheroes Have Bad Days.
That is so fucking cool. And the BBC doesn't get many things right, Ralph, like their right-wing leaning news and current affairs coverage. But stuff like this, they do amazingly well. I mean, imagine Captain America reading you a bedtime story. In your case, Ralph, it'd probably be Scarlet Witch in a low-cut bodice. Yeah, I heard you on Tuesday, you old perv.
I do like me some Elizabeth Olsen.
Me too. So Elton recently announced that he'll stop touring after a mammoth series of gigs to spend time with his children and his cash. The father of two said, family is always really important to me, no less so than this year, where they've been supporting me on my farewell tour launch and also working on the movie Sherlock Gnomes. Back off! And by supporting him, presumably he means staying at home in one of their many luxury properties, waiting for a scheduled 15 minutes FaceTime per day as he completes his 3-year world tour.
Wow.
And it's ridiculous. I now get to read a bedtime story to families all over the UK on CBeebies. Yeah, well, I won't be watching that with my little one. He sounds like my gran after her third stroke and looks like a thumb in a wig. Nothing going to put her to sleep on that. She'll have nightmares all night. But I've got to go, Ralph. I'm sorry. It's the weekend, and I've got to see my doctor about my weekend. Oh, it's all about that. Probably all that football from one knee on Wednesday.
Oh, boy. Goodbye, Steve.
Bye.
It is Friday. That means new movies in all the Cineplexes. This weekend, it looks like a lot of movie companies just took the weekend off. They figured, look, Avengers Infinity War, it's just crushing the competition. Let's not get lost in the shuffle. Let's hold off for a couple weeks. Let things die down a little bit before we start to release more films. So just a couple movies coming out this weekend. We'll look at them all, though, with the Movie Beat. Overboard opens up this weekend. If that name sounds familiar, it's because it is indeed a remake of that classic 80s comedy with Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell, where Goldie Hawn is a rich bitch, in quotes, who treats poor Kurt Russell, the humble working man, poorly, but she falls off her yacht and she gets amnesia, and he convinces her that she is his wife and mother of his kids, and she becomes a housewife, but she learns to love her humble existence with her carpenter boyfriend, and everyone learns an important lesson about life and love, as they always do in those films. Well, it's back. A lot of people are upset, by the way. I'm shocked and stunned that the Overboard fan base is so passionate, but a lot of people upset that they're remaking this film. And what they've done is they've flipped the genders. Now you've got Eugenio Derbez, who is a huge Latin American movie star. Not so big here in the States, but in Mexico and Latin America, big, big movie star. And Anna Faris stars as a lowly carpet cleaner who gets berated by this rich Mexican playboy. And when he gets amnesia, she makes him think that he's her husband, and she puts him to work. Ha! update, switch, yeah, genders. Here's a little taste.
I don't know what day it is. I don't even know my own name.
Amnesia in our little town.
That's him. I have an idea. It is poetic in its justice. I'm here to pick up my husband.
You really my wife?
For better or worse, baby.
Is it possible we're still making amnesia jokes in 2018? In the 21st century, is that still a viable comic mechanism? Gillingham got hit on the head with a coconut and he can't remember anything. We're still playing that card? Man, I thought we were better than that, but apparently not. Also opening up this weekend, Tully. You heard about Tully. We talked about this film. This is the Charlize Theron film, where she plays a mother of three, including a newborn. And in order to play the film and to represent how downtrodden and exhausted and overwhelmed this woman was, Charlize put on like 50 pounds or something for this role. And it was one of the examples I gave to her when I said, couldn't we find an actress who's 50 pounds overweight and we could put her in that role and let a new star be born? But look, if you got Charlize Theron, you're going to use her, right? It is some of her old friends are back working with her in this film, including Jason Reitman, who directs this film, directed her in a film called Young Adult that she was terrific in. This is the story, as I mentioned, of a mother of three, including a newborn, who is gifted a night nanny by her brother, who's played by Mark Duplass in this film. It gives her a chance to catch her breath, but little does she expect that the night nanny who shows up to watch her kids at night so she can sleep, the titular Tully, changes her life in ways she could never imagine. Mackenzie Davis plays Tully. Here's a little clip from the trailer.
Do you know what a night nanny is? They take care of the baby at night so mom and dad can get some sleep.
I don't want a stranger in my house. It's like a Lifetime movie where the nanny tries to kill the family and the mom survives and she has to walk with a cane at the end.
Ron Livingston also stars as Charlize Theron's husband in this film, Lucky Bastard. It seems to have a pretty good pedigree. This is great counter-programming for the giant scope of a film like Avengers, Infinity War. This is the other side, smaller, personal little film that a lot of people might want to check out who have already seen the big blockbuster. And for the kids, there's another animated film out this weekend called Son of Bigfoot. Adam is an awkward kid at school, and he feels like he doesn't fit in. And then he finds out that his dad is none other than the legendary Bigfoot. You know how it is. Here's a clip.
Who are you?
I'm not sure how to break this to you,
but I'm your dad.
My dad is Bigfoot?
Yep.
Could my life get any worse?
No.
Am I gonna be like you?
You'd have symptoms by now.
Like hair that grows a foot overnight? Huh? Feet that blow through the ends of my shoes?
There's one more thing. You can talk to animals.
How you doing, fellas?
Pleased to meet you.
So Adam discovers he's got the same superpowers as his dad, Bigfoot, and Bigfoot's being hunted down, and Adam has to save his dad. And I could not help but think during the trailer, so Bigfoot fucked some broad and got her knocked up, and that's where this kid comes from? A woman had sex with Bigfoot, voluntarily had sex with Bigfoot, and that's how this kid came along. I hope they address that in the film, because that is the stuff of nightmares. Those are your movies opening up this weekend. I'm Ralph Garman, and I walk the movie beat. And now it's the end of the week. Time to wrap up my interview with Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, the creative minds behind The Joe Schmo Show. In this episode, we talk more about the creation of Joe Schmo 2, what we went through to produce that, how disappointed we were when that wasn't met with the same amount of success as the first film. We talk about also the legacy of the various incarnations of The Joe Schmo Show. Those people who love it really, really love it, and that's very satisfying for us. Here's a little bit more of the history of The Joe Schmo Show with myself, Rhett Reese, and Paul Wernick.
Well, and then, of course, we made that big mistake. Remember, right at the beginning, we had that woman out front who was playing one of the contestants, yes, who confessed to Ingrid Wies that essentially her agent had got her this gig. Like,
well, she was an extra. We had cast her to be one of the
people. She was essentially a day player, and we'd sort of made the mistake of not revealing the total truth to her. I mean, we and telling her how important the secret was. We kind of gave her half-truths about what she was doing, which was always a huge... That was something, if we could change it, we would have. But she, on the opening day, confesses to Ingrid that you know, she, well, her agent,
how did you get on the show?
Got her this job. Yeah. And so Ingrid's antenna went straight up into the air.
She was too smart.
And of course, the network and the studio, we're all watching that. And so all of a sudden it was like, oh no, we're in real trouble here. And we were in real trouble. Like, she really got onto us. By day two, she'd figured out the whole thing.
Yeah. One of the secrets of espionage we've learned is you don't tell people, if you want people to keep a secret, let them in on the secret.
Yeah, it's true.
Because if you kind of give them half information, they don't know what they're protecting.
Yes.
They don't know what they're protecting.
That's exactly right.
And so this woman who came on, who was a day player, didn't have all the information, didn't know that the whole show centered around these two people. And
she didn't give anything up because she didn't know there was something
exactly
to give up.
Yeah. So we've learned that, and it was a hard lesson to learn, that you give people all the information.
Yeah, make them sign them an NDA, impress upon them how secret it is, but tell them the whole story. So she got onto us, and you remember how stressful that was. I mean, she was rolling her eyes, like everything we did. Instead of getting that genuine reaction, she's rolling her eyes going,
she's like, I'll just play along on television.
When's my script coming under my door? She said at one point when we were like, oh God. So to us, that cut at the heart of our show. Like, our show was entirely about reactions of real people to the craziness. And the minute she wasn't reacting right, and we ran the risk of her poisoning Tim, because he still was believing it. Paul and I just made the decision, we got to pull her out of there. But Stone Stanley was really, really convinced that, no, your job is to reel her back in. Keep her in and reel her back in.
And there's no reeling back in. Them coming from a reality background, they just figured, look, we can cut it. We can cut the show. We can edit the show any way we want. So even if she knows the truth and she's playing along, we can kind of edit it to present it any way we want to the audience. So, but our feeling was what made the first show so magical was those honest reactions of Matt Kennedy Gould. And we weren't getting them out of Ingrid. And that was.
So we made, after about three straight super late nights, you remember where we were there 2 hours after arguing over what to
do. How do we fix this?
You know, how do we fix this? Knowing that we all had to go sleep and get back and do it again in the morning, we decided to pull her out, and we told her the truth, obviously, and we brought her in on the joke. And then she became an improv actor, and we brought in a new woman to replace her, and it went swimmingly from that moment forward. She was great. She did a great job acting.
I think the genius was, and you guys really took advantage of any contingency, was that we gave her the choice, remember? We said, you can leave now.
Right.
And you'll get your money.
Right.
And we'll say goodbye and we'll part as friends. Or if you want to keep playing along, you become one of us.
Yeah.
And
brought her to the dark side. Yeah.
Thank God she decided to join me.
She did. And she did a great stand-up job for someone who's never done improv. And we entrusted her with at least one important plot. Remember the dead grandmother? Anyway, you just got to see it. The dead grandmother, right? That you got to go see that.
Come on,
the dead Falcon, the dead grandmother, like there was crazy stuff.
But I resented every time some executive would come over and start to debate funny with us. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't mind talking about their choices in television
or editing or plot
points. But when they started trying to chime in on what they thought was funnier and rewrite jokes or kill jokes, because that made me nuts on that shoot. And it happened more and more as the thing went along.
I think it was just out of fear. It was just, we were
of
all,
course,
under, they were so afraid.
It all, those people always act out of fear.
Yeah, we were all under an intense amount of pressure, and I don't know. It's just one of those things, labor of love, really hard when you're in it. You know, gray hair is going onto your head, but at the end, you look at it and go, yeah, it's great. I love that season.
You remember the moment when we had Amanda, who was the replacement girl, the third schmo who came in. We had her in that fat suit.
Oh, my God.
And she was pretending to be the cousin, her own cousin.
Oh, my God. It's the best. That was Paul's idea.
She's talking to one of our bachelors. It was the bachelor. It was Austin.
It was Austin, right?
He's talking to Austin. And he believes that
it's not her.
And I was serving dinner to the cousin in the fat suit and her family. And it was time for dessert. And one of the gags was I was supposed to bring out little slices of cake for everyone to have a dessert. And I brought out
human-sized pieces for all of her family, and then there was a giant wedge of cake that we were going to put on the plate.
Actually, that is so great.
We were going to put on a plate in front of Amanda, who's dressed in this giant fat suit, and not comment on it, but I'm just giving a dessert to everyone.
Did that make it onto the screen?
Did we see it?
And
I'll tell you why. Because Palin Chow said, "You can't do that. You're making fun of her being fat."
Oh, man. We said...
But she's not fat. She's in a fat suit, but she's not really a fat person,
God,
so we're not hurting her feelings.
So
she said,
funny.
No, but it seems like you're hurting her feelings. And we're like, no, but it doesn't, because the audience knows it's really Amanda in prosthetic makeup, so they won't think we're hurting her feelings. God. And she killed that gag, and we never got to do it. And that was when I said,
there were some other
I don't want any more people from the network making decisions on jokes.
We had a thing planned where... when Tim got kicked off the show, we actually kicked she booted Tim. So we had a Joe Schmo get kicked off the show.
Yeah.
And then we had this twist where it was a foul, but he was at his hotel right. And we had this food cart show up.
Room service.
And that was going to be the reveal but what we were going to do is we were going to put you under the table with your head sticking out. Now, knowing that you're claustrophobic now, this may not have worked, but we were going to put that big silver,
the dome
over your head, and it was supposed to come off, and it was going to be Derek Newcastle's head saying, "You're back on the show." And then that actually got killed, which
killed
our heart.
I haven't seen the show in a very long time, but the last time I saw it, there was a scene. Remember the interrogation scene where the lie detector.
Oh yes.
And we were in the garage, the basement, and the light was swinging back and forth. And
it was like a Jonathan Torrance area or something.
Jonathan Torrance is
the gotta be gay guy.
Gerald,
with a hard G. And the dad was giving.
Do you want to have sex with my daughter? And Jonathan Torrance went, "Yes," and confessed. Yeah. And then the lie detector guy gave the thumbs down, indicating
like,
that he'd lied.
Is there anyone in the house that you have a crush on? And he's like, "Man or woman?"
Something like it was.
It was. I maintain
all
that
the women in the house.
Yeah. And then again.
Really self-congratulatory, sitting here laughing at our own stuff.
But it's not. It's the work of Jonathan Torrance.
God, it makes me laugh. Yeah. Oh, my God. Jonathan Torrance.
You had a line in that show. We still quote it.
Yeah.
We still quote it almost daily. And it was out of your brilliant head, which was – it was the porn shoot that
one of the staples of reality TV was that various women would get on these shows, and then it would be revealed through the press that they'd done porn.
That's right. Yes.
And so we decided to put that in the show. And
Cammy,
it was discovered that she'd been in a porn video, fetish video, which I think was your idea.
Food porn.
My brother Caleb was this French chef who poured Franks and beans over her in a hot tub.
That we shot at the Days Inn on Hollywood.
Or Sunset, one of those. Yeah. But I think it was Sunset. Like
illegally,
no permit, guerrilla style.
Like real porn.
In a motel room.
Poured beans into a tub.
We lined a tub with plastic so we wouldn't ruin it, and we poured Franks and beans, like literally a tub full of Franks and beans all over her. My brother pouring it all over her in his little French chef outfit with the apron and the hat. I mean, it was so good. But let's get to the scene. So Cammy fails in some challenge. And so your job as host is to come out and to reveal something embarrassing about her to the other contestants. So you played the tape in front of all the other people.
To the horror of everyone.
And at the end, Ralph says, "What?
It's a shame you all had to see this on such a small monitor."
Just the slight pause on such a small monitor.
Oh, God. It was, again, every time we watch TV, I say that line. It's so great.
So the show wraps, and that was, I'll tell you, as much as the first one made me nervous when we revealed what was going on, the second one made me even more nervous because I was afraid of Tim's reaction, and you touched on that a little bit. I didn't know how he was going to feel about finding out that he didn't really have a shot with Piper, and that was all going to go south. And I said we had a pretty good reveal show, and we talked afterwards, and he seemed, like you said, to have a pretty good sense of humor about it and stuff.
He made the transition from angry to accepting, you know, pretty – very with a lot of grace, I thought.
Yeah. And then the show went on the air and we didn't do as well as we did the first time around, much to Spike's disappointment and ours as well.
I still maintain it's a pretty big head scratcher that, that people who watched the first Joe Schmo didn't watch the second Joe Schmo.
Yeah. I still to this day can't figure it out.
It's like you watch a season of Seinfeld, you love it. You come back for season two.
Interestingly, by today's standards, Joe Schmo 2 did not do that badly. Like, it had 800,000 or 900,000 viewers, which, like, in today's television that's all fractured, it's like 800,000 or 900,000 viewers is a lot. Like, but back then, it was like, we can't do season three. We just don't have the ratings.
Yeah, so, they weren't interested.
Now, of course, we ended up doing season three. We didn't, but you did, along with John Moore, 10 years later.
Yeah.
And that was a rousing success quality-wise. It also didn't do great ratings, but I who knows why. Maybe it was just, you know,
lightning in a bottle.
And I also think because of the world we live in where there's so much reality television that it's not really – I mean, it's still special work, but I don't think it stands out as much as it did the first couple
times.
There are
1,000 reality shows on right now. 420 scripted shows and 1,000 reality shows.
That's not an actual number, is it?
No, that's a real number.
Is it?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. 1,000 new shows on now.
How's that even
that's what
possible?
I read. I think
it's
true.
Well, I think that includes all the American Pickers and all the things.
Everything.
Everything that's shot.
Everything that's shot in any which way.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily like a competition stuff, but just shows about people doing
stuff. How do you break through that clutter? Yeah, how do you break through that clutter?
And how do you seem to be parodying something where there are so many real ridiculous people, you know, on the Real Housewives of whatever city being characters and clowns. Yeah. How do you even parody that?
Yeah, anymore? It's like it's almost self-parody, those shows. I mean, in the third season, you guys did the Bounty Hunter thing, which is hilarious. You were doing a version of Dog the Bounty Hunter, which was hilarious. But I think ultimately, you know, it's a high-risk show.
Yeah.
And I think when the reward isn't that high in terms of ratings, I think it starts to become – feels like an unnecessary gamble for a network. So I doubt we'll see a Joe Schmo 4. I would love it. Maybe enough years pass, but
and again, we were real proud of the third one in terms of the content and the comedy that we got. We had Lorenzo Lamas playing himself on the show, and there were some ridiculous funny things on it.
Yeah.
But I think maybe the – like you said, the climate has just changed so much, that the world has changed so much that people, they're like, that's kind of cute, but it's not earth-shattering. It doesn't really grab anybody's attention anymore.
Right. It's interesting. Well, I met my wife at the rap party, so that worked out.
That was worth doing the show alone.
I know.
The lovely Chelsea Crisp, yes.
Yeah, so looking back, place Joe Schmo into context, how do you think it'll go down historically if it goes down at all? I mean, it's like I know the new generation doesn't really know anything about it, but there is this core group of fans who just adore it.
Well, I mentioned Colin Hanks at the beginning of this, and I've run into several other people, including Ilan Gale, who is the producer of The Bachelor.
Oh yeah, we're huge reality TV folks.
People have come up to me more than one occasion. People whose opinions I respect, who are professionals. And just people who are everyday fans who say it is the greatest reality show that they've ever seen.
That's really nice.
And that's we can't ask for more than that.
That's really nice. I do feel like it was a it was unique in a entertainment world where very little is unique. It was its own weird thing, and it was an experiment. It was part social experiment, part parody, part comedy. Part live television feel. Like it was
drama
just,
and hard.
It was unmatched. Really, really weird. And
it worked on every level that you guys had sort of built into it, which is rare that something works on all of those levels. Because it was tried after us with Joe Millionaire and all these other things that kind of came after us. And to varying degrees of success, but none of them hit, I think, ticked off all the boxes. Like,
what was that show that aired on Fox about that fat guy?
Fat obnoxious fiance.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, they tried one.
That was the opposite. It was one actor being inserted into a family full of real people or whatever, and they tried to get their reactions to their daughter married.
Yes.
And we tried with Invasion Iowa. We took William Shatner to a small town in Iowa and did a fun hoax there where we fooled the whole town into thinking he was shooting a movie there. It was really a real high wire act. But I think you're right about just like the wow factor had sort of gone out of it at that point after a few years. And so it was tough to get eyeballs. We're very proud of that too, but I don't know. It, to me, it's like this wonderful, I just think back and it's like this wonderful, glowing, funny, you know, experience.
The most fun
we ever had.
And I'm still, I think of all the work I've done, I'm most proud of, of that.
We feel the
for
same.
Sure. Yeah. And people have a real affection for it, and it keeps coming up time and time again. I told you guys the story. I was in Vancouver shooting a movie called Two for the Money with Matthew McConaughey and Al Pacino. And they were staying at the hotel, this place in Vancouver called the Sutton Place, which is where they put all the actors and stuff when you're shooting up there. And so I was sitting at the bar one night, and I think it was the maitre d' or the concierge or somebody at the hotel came up to me, and he said, "Excuse me, sir." And I was like, "Yeah, they're going to throw me out, or I'm like, doing something wrong." Every time I hear "excuse me, sir," anywhere in trouble,
nothing good comes out of that.
It's probably happened a few times.
And he said, "We get a lot of people who work in television and film in this place, and we're under strict orders not to bother anyone, and I would never do this. But if I have my roommate bring my box set of the Joe Schmo Show, could you sign it for me?" And I was like, "Absolutely." He goes, "It is still the greatest TV show I've ever seen."
Oh, that's great.
I get, from time to time throughout my day, invariably someone will come up to me and talk about that show. It is for the people who saw it and witnessed it and remember it, it is beloved.
It was so special. It remains special. It again is our favorite thing we've ever done, the most fun we've ever had. It will forever be, you know, our first thing we've ever done.
Never forget your first love, right?
Yeah,
truly.
Exactly.
And you know, I think what's happened over the last two decades since we've done this show is
decade and a half. Come on now.
We're still all young.
We were so wide-eyed and so naive, and we didn't even know what we had, you know, and we wouldn't take no for an answer. Like, we've grown so cynical over the last 15 years.
Right. We wouldn't even ask for some of the things that we've done.
Yeah,
on the
show, right.
Yeah. We knew there's no way that's going to happen.
Yeah. And that naivety, really, I think, comes across in the show in a really heartfelt, awesome way.
There's that great Bob Seger line, "Wish I didn't know now what I didn't know then."
Right.
And it's just like, I kind of wish I could just take all the cynicism and just go back to that, the days of Joe Schmo when it was just, it was a honeymoon.
There was a let's put on a show kind of vibe.
Yeah, it really was.
People
it was like
just pitching in and doing this
thing.
Stuff.
Yeah. And again, that sheer exhilaration of opening up the gift every time a scene would start because you had no clue what was coming.
Yeah.
Just no clue. You'd done your best to prepare that scene. You had the best people in there. It's Kristen Wiig and it's Brian Keith Etheridge and it's Lance Kral. And yet you have this guy who could do anything and was really liable to do anything given his personality. What a blast.
It's so rare to take improv comedy and use it well on television.
Yeah.
And I think the reason behind that is when you're sitting in a theater watching someone do improv, it's impressive because it's happening right in front of your eyes. It's kind of like a magic trick.
Yeah. Oh, good. A good point.
But on television, where everything is cut and prepackaged and written and lit and shot, there's no sense of danger to
no,
it all.
It's true.
But you guys were able to find the only successful version of improv comedy I've ever seen was done by you guys because you brought the danger back to that because you had the audience guy standing right next to the people who were doing it. And that's what you watched to see if at any moment they were going to fall off the ledge.
I still think there's an opportunity out there for a live, I know it's been done with musicals but like a live show, like it's, you know, a live sitcom. I know they've had episodes of that, you know, in various forms
and
fashions.
Yeah, there's an electricity to live.
Yeah. But it feels like a real opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, just to capture what we captured when you would go in and do your game and then run back out to the monitors and we'd watch the reaction together, all experiencing it live. That's a very, very powerful, entertaining feeling.
And don't forget, all you generals 2-star and above, you will be getting the entirety of that interview as an audio bonus later this weekend. Sorry that segment ran a little bit long, but I did want to wrap things up for everybody. In this case, the actual entire interview will have some legitimate bonus audio content because at the end of the interview, after we were done talking about the Joe Schmo Show, I did talk to the fellas about Deadpool 2, which comes out on the 18th, which they wrote. And so a little extra legitimate bonus audio will be at the end of that version that I send out this weekend. That is it for today's show for a Friday. I hope you have a terrific weekend. Let's touch base on Monday and compare notes and see how we all did. Take care of yourself. Be careful out there. Why? Because I love you and I mean it. Bye.